Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Neil Kelly, bringing you today's Yuma Sun Daily with a look at life in and around Yuma. We begin with local news, and the first article is titled, Two Mayoral Candidates Explain Reasons for Seeking the Office, by Michael Maresch, Sun Staff Reporter. Yuma voters in July have a choice in deciding who they want to lead Yuma as mayor. The two mayoral candidates who have announced their intentions to run in the July 21st primary election have slightly different views on why they are seeking the seat. Incumbent Douglas Nichols is being opposed by write-in candidate Carlos Adams. Others wanting to run as write-in candidates have until May 22nd to file for the primary election. Adams said he is running for mayor because he believes the true voice of Yuma has gone unheard for far too long. Too many residents feel left out of important decisions, and too many major projects move forward without enough transparency or public involvement. I believe city government works for the people, not the other way around, Adams said. Every dollar matters, and all of our priorities should reflect the needs of our community stronger with public safety, better roads, improved parks, and responsible growth. He also said he believes the community's future depends on investing in people. That means supporting small businesses, listening to working families, and creating opportunities for our youth. I want to help activate the parts of our community that feel ignored and make sure every voice in Yuma matters, he said. Nichols said he is honored to serve as mayor of the community that is his home and the best place to raise a family. I lead with integrity, a strong work ethic, and with a goal to ensure Yuma stays Yuma while we aim for a brighter future, Nichols said. Nichols said he will use his years of experience as mayor and knowledge of public policy to propel Yuma's initiatives to increase economic growth and job opportunities, to keep decision-making local, and continue two-way dialogue with constituents. Your voice matters, he said. Now more than ever, we must be united for Yuma. As leaders, we must deliberate with each city department's master planning while always seeking ways to keep Yuma, Yuma. We cannot lose our identity. We cannot lose the spirit of Yuma, he said. I truly believe that through my service, I can help brighten Yuma's future and plan for the growth we as a community want and that future generations of Yumans deserve, Nichols added. The next article is titled, Spirit of Humanity, Teresa Burgo, by Matilda Carpenter, Sun Staff Writer. At 98 years old, Teresa Burgo has a lot of life to look back on. When asked to talk about those years, what came back time and again was service to others. Whether it was helping with her church or taking care of those with nowhere left to turn, Burgo spent her time making the world brighter for those around her. Burgo, who has lived in Yuma for over 30 years, was originally born in Lowell, Massachusetts in 1929. In her years living in our town, she has extensively spent her time volunteering with her church, which by a coincidental twist of fate features the same altar from the church where she was baptized in Lowell. The church over here, the whole altar and the archway, comes from the church I was baptized in, she recalled. My mom and dad got married at that church. According to Burgo, the altar was relocated to Yuma after the original church shuttered its doors. Though Burgo had nothing to do with the decision to bring the altar to Yuma, it was a pleasant surprise that a piece of her town, her home, felt followed her across the country. It is at that church where Burgo pours her support into the community, volunteering at a variety of events and functions, even opening her doors to those who need help when the occasion calls. I just volunteered all the time I've been out here, she said. Burgo's favorite part of volunteering is interacting with others. I go for visiting and company and all the people that I just loved. I started out with this craft, making little Christmas decorations 15 years ago. I started out with 50, and this one man came up and he says to me, "Where's mine?" I came home and I made him one and brought it to him, and that smile on his face was worth $1 million. That sense of charitable and community interaction is fundamental to how Burgo spends her time. I just love everybody. I'd give them the shirt off my back if I had to, she said. I helped take care of these four men that were on oxygen 24/7. I promised my girlfriend I'd take care of her son if her and her husband died, and I brought him over here. Burgo recalled some of the hurdles fulfilling that promise. He had a steel plate in his head, and he had seizures, but he sure did love me, and I loved that kid, she said. I took care of him because his son didn't want him. This priceless dedication to the community and her church has helped many throughout the years. I took care of all these people, went and brought them lunch, brought them their birthday cake on their birthday, and had cake and ice cream, she recalled. For Borgo, one of the primary drivers of this extraordinary service is her faith, which she holds as a guiding principle in her life. I just prayed to him, help me take away the pain away. And he did, said Borgo, who is battling a tumor. Gesturing towards a portrait she had of Jesus, she added, you didn't want me, so I got some more work to do. And I don't mind helping people. I'll take them in here. I'll buy a couch to give them room to sleep and everything. When Borgo first came to Yuma, she recalls that she was one of the first people to move in on the street. Looking back at her life, Borgo attributes her long years to her active lifestyle. Just keep busy, and that's what I did. I painted the trim of the house at 88 years old. I've done a lot of work for a lot of people, she said. That's what I'm doing. See, I'll be 99 this year. I'm going to make 100 next. Our next local news story is titled, Two Drivers Critically Injured in Head-On Crash on Airport Loop, by James Gilbert, Sun Staff Writer. Two people were critically injured Wednesday morning after a three-vehicle collision on East Airport Loop, according to the Yuma County Sheriff's Office. Deputies were called to the scene at about 7:55 a.m., following reports of a crash between Avenue A and West County 14th Street. The initial investigation found that a 1998 Toyota Tacoma, traveling southbound, crossed the center line for unknown reasons and struck a northbound 2021 Toyota Corolla head-on. A 2020 Ford Explorer, traveling behind the Corolla, swerved onto the gravel shoulder to avoid the crash, sustaining damage but leaving the driver and passengers uninjured. Rural Metro Fire transported the drivers of both vehicles to Onvita Health with critical injuries. They were later flown to a Phoenix area hospital for further treatment. Deputies said it is not yet known whether impairment played a role in the collision. The investigation remains ongoing. Anyone with information is asked to contact the Yuma County Sheriff's Office at 928-783-4427 or call 78-CRIME to remain anonymous. Tips may also be submitted online at yumacountysheriff.org. The next article is titled, Cat Gets Second Chance at Life Through Humane Society of Yuma, by Matilda Carpenter, Sun Staff Writer. While it can be easy to overlook our four-legged neighbors, stray animals in Yuma face frequent threats of physical harm from a variety of sources, which can leave them in dire straits without intervention. One such animal is Fancy, a cat that was brought to the Humane Society of Yuma and is currently recovering from a surgery that removed her tail following one such injury. We believe she was caught in an engine. She had severe trauma to her tail, said Hillary Mulherin, development manager at HSOY. It was still intact, but basically it had suffered a lot of trauma. When Fancy was brought to the Humane Society, staff believed she was only around 6 months old. For kittens and cats to be in engines is pretty common, unfortunately, said Mulherin. They go up there for protection and everything. The injuries she had were pretty indicative of that. We have seen it before. As part of her recovery, Fancy had to have her tail removed and the skin given time to heal. While the initial plan called for skin grafts, the lucky cat was able to proceed without them. Now, safely recuperating with a foster family. Stories like Fancy's emphasize the importance of checking cars for animals, but also the vital role organizations like the Humane Society of Yuma play in keeping animal populations healthy. We can take in any that are sick or injured. With Fancy's case, she was definitely injured, and those are cases we send to foster care immediately, Mulherin explained, adding, of course, we intake them. We give them all their vaccines and things, and our veterinarian will do an exam on them. Then we have a dedicated network of fosters. When it comes to animals who are found in rough shape, like Fancy, Mulherin advises Yuma residents to reach out to animal control. That should be your first bet, but don't put yourself in a dangerous situation, she advised. But if you're able to assist, then people will bring animals to us all the time. But number one, call animal control. For more information on HSOY or for ways to support the shelter, go to hsoyuma.com. The next article is titled, Plea Against Former Police Officer Continued, by Michael Maresch, Sun Staff Writer. The plea deal for a former Yuma police officer on domestic violence charges was continued in Welton Municipal Court on Wednesday after the prosecutor realized similar charges against Gustavo Ramirez were dismissed 2 weeks ago in Yuma Superior Court. In a telephonic conference, the prosecutor said she was out last week, so she just found out about the dismissal by reading a news story about it. Ramirez also attended Wednesday's meeting telephonically. The prosecutor said she needed to review the reasons for the dismissal and also needed to talk to the victim. Judge Ross Jones granted a 2-week continuance and rescheduled the change of plea to May 6th at 11 a.m. Ramirez, 37, had been charged with domestic violence, stalking, and harassment in Yuma Superior Court. According to court documents, the charges were dismissed without prejudice, meaning they could be filed again. Police and court documents indicate that officers responded to a report of a suspicious incident in the 4000 block of West 24th Street in Yuma on the afternoon of September 1, 2025. An investigation determined that a disturbance involving Ramirez had occurred earlier in the day, the agency said. Police arrested and booked Ramirez on charges of disorderly conduct and harassment, both under domestic violence statutes. Following his arrest, Ramirez was placed on administrative leave pending further investigation. Asked about Ramirez's status in the Yuma Police Department following the charge dismissal, Police Chief Thomas Garrity told the Yuma Sun in a written statement, "It is the department's policy not to comment on individual personnel matters. The department stands by its administrative procedures, guided by law, policy, and fairness. These processes are designed to ensure transparency where appropriate, accountability in our actions, and fair treatment for every member of the organization. These standards help us maintain the expectations and the trust placed in us by the community we serve." We move on now to state news, and the first article there is titled, Players Say MLB's Robot Umpires Are Shrinking the Strike Zone, by David Brandt, AP baseball writer. Phoenix, AP. Arizona Diamondback closer Paul Sewald knows that, in theory, Major League Baseball's new automated ball strike system shouldn't favor batters or pitchers. In practice, he thinks one side has gained an advantage, and it's not the guys throwing the baseball. "It's what MLB wanted, people on base," Sewald said. "Tough time to be a pitcher. Balls flying everywhere. You've got a smaller strike zone. But you just go out there and do the best you can." So, is Sewald right? It depends on which numbers you want to use, but it sure seems like the strike zone has shrunk. Walks have skyrocketed to near historic highs through the season's first month. There's no direct evidence ABS is the reason for the increase, but as D-backs catcher James McCann said, "Of course it is. What other rules have changed?" MLB players have drawn a walk in 9.8% of plate appearances this season through Wednesday's games, which would be the highest rate since 1950. The rate is likely to come down as the season progresses. Pitchers usually have more trouble finding the zone during widespread chilly conditions in northern cities during March and April. But even adjusted for the time of year, walks have made a massive jump from last season. "Everyone knew the strike zone would change. MLB had to rewrite its definition of the zone to accommodate the shift to robot umpires." The official baseball rules long described a zone stretching from the midpoint of the hitter's torso down to the hollow beneath the kneecap. The new zone is more precise. It starts at 27% of a batter's standing height and stretches to 53.5%. The ABS zone is 17 inches wide, matching the width of home plate. All pitches are measured at the midpoint of the plate. The spike in walks doesn't tell the whole story about who is benefiting during the ABS era. MLB's league-wide batting average is down slightly to 240 through Wednesday, a few ticks below the 242 rate through last year's games in March and April. That pokes a hole in Sewald's claim that there are balls flying everywhere. The difference in opinion is fascinating as MLB players digest the new rules and new data. New York Yankees outfielder Cody Bellinger isn't putting too much stock in the early numbers. He said hitters and pitchers are always playing a cat-and-mouse game, and there will eventually be equilibrium. I think there's always an adjustment to something new, the 2019 National League MVP said. It's also such a short sample size. It's 20 to 25 games into the season, so numbers skyrocket both ways early on. McCann's not so sure. The veteran catcher said a smaller strike zone will inevitably lead to more walks. I think it's tighter in general, McCann said. Umpires are getting instant feedback on what a strike or a ball, and everything's becoming much more uniform. That's what the guys who had used it in the minor leagues told me was going to happen before the season started, and they were exactly right. Chicago Cubs star infielder Nico Horner had a slightly different take, arguing that hitters might be benefiting in the short term by laying off pitches at the top of the strike zone, but that all adjustments have an expiration date. Getting on base has been emphasized for a long time, Horner said. Walking is incredibly valuable as a hitter. A lot of pitchers, their approach is to avoid slug at all cost. Sometimes that involves throwing less strikes. But I'm sure there will be a back and forth, just like every trend in baseball. If recent history is any indication, MLB rule changes can cause a lasting effect. There was a nearly 50% increase in stolen bases from 2022 to 2023 after a rules package introduced a pitch clock and limits on how many times a pitcher could make pickoff throws. Stolen bases have remained high in the subsequent years, even after teams adjusted to the new rules. And when MLB lowered the mound in 1969, the walk rate jumped from 7.6% to 9.1%. It dipped slightly after that, but didn't return below 8% again until 2013. Miami Marlins manager Clayton McCullough believes the ABS issue is a different animal. He's watching the trends and doesn't believe the higher walk rate is here to stay. Who knows? The next 5 months will tell the tale. I think that we'll get to a point where it gets close and stabilizes to what it's been, where relievers are walking around 10%. Starters are going to be more around 8%, McCullough said. My hypothesis sitting here now, early in the year, is that by the time the season ends, walk rates will look very much like they have, say, the last several seasons. The next article is titled, I Kept Finding My Way to Salt, by Rory Cunningham, Arizona Sonoran News. There are salt lakes around the world. The Great Salt Lake in Utah, the Aral Sea in Kazakhstan, the Salton Sea and Mono Lake in California. In her new book, Salt Lakes, journalist, author, and critic Carolyn Tracy takes readers to each in a story that explores these unique ecosystems and her own identity. The water in salt lakes comes from freshwater rivers, but throughout history, these rivers have been diverted for human use, irrigation, canals, industry. As these lakes receive less water, they dry up, killing the organisms living there and revealing harmful minerals that can be picked up by the wind and lead to harmful levels of air pollution. Tracy, who has a PhD in geography from the University of California, Berkeley, shares a collection of her writings about her visits to these salt lakes, people she has met, and her personal journeys. In Salt Lakes, Tracy takes a piece of her own life to look at salt lakes through a new, queer perspective. She investigates the lakes using queer ecology, a framework that explores the different non-heteronormative relationships in nature, like those in salt lakes. Tracy held a book launch for Salt Lakes in March at Antigone Books in Tucson. The following conversation has been edited for length and clarity. Question: what made you realize you wanted to write this book? In the book, you mentioned how salt and salt lakes were following you. When did you realize this and what they meant to you? Carolyn Tracy. I started wanting to write a book, kind of forever ago. I always wanted to be a writer. This particular book, I didn't know was going to take the form that it did until almost halfway through the process. I started noticing salt lakes when I was in my early 20s, when I was on road trips around California and Nevada. And I got really interested in what they were, why they existed, and why they were kind of such strange features in the landscape. But at the time, I was really interested in writing personal essays, very inspired by writers like Joan Didion. And at the time, Roxane Gay was a really big writer in 2014 that had just come out with a really big book. So that was the type of thing I was interested in writing, and over time, I just realized that environmental reportage and scientific research was really interesting to me. So I gradually started to kind of shape the book more around salt lakes, because I had realized they were a theme, and I thought then you could have a pathway through a collection of essays that's following the salt lakes. But then I realized, what if it was just a whole book about the salt lakes? And that was a really important turning point, because it made it into not necessarily a book of personal essays, even though I think the result is somewhat essayistic and personalistic, but also a book that was kind of about this thing called salt lakes. Question. Going off of that, what was the most memorable or important experience you had that really solidified your passion for the salt lakes? Answer. On some level, I'm like, they are all super memorable. Part of me is like, I didn't spend nearly enough time at salt lakes. But then when I look back, I spent tons of really important times of my life at salt lakes. The visit to the Salton Sea that I describe in Chapter 2 was really formative because that kind of kicked off my whole interest. But then I describe, a little later in the book, I took this really long train journey to the Aral Sea in Central Asia, and I think that was when I felt really kind of committed to the topic, because I went on this journey that was challenging to plan and expensive. And so I was like, okay, I guess I'm really into this topic now. Then when I got back, I tried to write an essay about it, but I was just so engrossed by the research that I had just thousands and thousands of words about the history of the Aral Sea, that it didn't take a readable form until the final version you read in the book. It never got published as a standalone, I think, because it was just too long. Question. How did you feel writing this book? Answer. I feel like the book was such a part of my life, and almost my daily life, for a really long time because I was always just working on it. So it kind of accompanied me through a lot of different times in my life. I don't think I felt any one specific way while I was writing it, just because it did take such a long time, but I would say that the project became almost like my companion. It was something that was steady, and I think it's one of the nice things about being a writer. You always have a purpose in your life. Maybe not if you don't have a project, but when you have a project, you feel a sense of purpose, and I guess maybe that's the thing that's nice about it. Question. How did you want your book to make readers feel? Answer. People have asked me if I want people to become obsessed with salt lakes, which, I guess, I certainly would love for lawmakers in Utah to read it and pass certain legislation related to the Great Salt Lake, and not only Utah, but all the different states that have these ecosystems. For more ordinary readers, I don't necessarily want them to feel like they need to become obsessed with salt lakes specifically, or feel like they need to go visit a salt lake. I would say maybe one thing it can do is show people that there are all kinds of unusual ecosystems and aspects of the natural world that you can become really interested in, and that may be threatened in ways that people aren't paying attention to, but are still important. I think that my goal is that people can kind of find their own salt lakes. It doesn't have to be something in nature, but find something that they find really fruitful in terms of, like, an obsession or something that speaks to their life in a certain way. Question. How did you feel learning about how the Paiute and other indigenous tribes understood the hydrology of the lakes? Did it reaffirm your connection to them? Answer. Yeah, I think it's sort of like one of the things that a lot of writers, scholars, and activists are thinking about right now. There are a lot of conversations going on about the fact that there is a lot of indigenous knowledge that we often taught was kind of lost or erased. And actually, there is a lot of indigenous knowledge that has been passed down to the present day, whether or not those of us who are not indigenous know about it. So, for me, it felt like it was important to ensure that I was able to speak with some people who could talk with me about the role of the salt lakes played in those cultures. Because a lot of the book is about the destruction of salt lakes by settlers, with irrigation diversions and other types of policies. So it was useful for me to learn that there is a way to kind of steward these lakes over time and hold them as an important place culturally. It was also a really interesting pattern to me that many different cultures had really valued these salt lakes and found them to be striking and interesting and even sacred. And so it made me feel like there was a reason that they were so alluring to me. The next article is titled, Water to Surge into Drought-Depleted Lake Powell, But at Costs Elsewhere, by Mead Groover and Dorani Pineda, Associated Press. Fort Collins, Colorado. Canyons in eastern Utah will churn this spring with huge volumes of water, as much as 50,000 toilets flushing constantly at the same time, in a desperate attempt to maintain electricity generation for thousands of homes across much of the western U.S. The Green and Colorado River flows might seem like a bounty of moisture in a parched desert of sandstone arches and prickly cacti, but in fact, it's just the opposite. After the driest winter on record, officials this spring want to raise the level of badly depleted Lake Powell on the Colorado River to keep its hydropower humming. To do so, they plan to eventually let out as much as a third of the water in Flaming Gorge Reservoir upstream on the Green River in Wyoming and Utah, which would exceed a record 2022 surge that kept electricity flowing. Lake Powell, held back by Glen Canyon Dam, supplies inexpensive and carbon-free electricity to more than 350,000 homes, but it comes at a growing cost elsewhere in a contested river basin relied upon heavily by ranchers, industries, and some 40 million residential water customers. At Flaming Gorge in southwestern Wyoming, Buckboard Marina owners Tony and Jen Valdez are eyeing water levels expected to decline by 10 feet by late summer because of the releases. It will mean an ever longer drive to the water's edge to launch boats. "Of course, we're concerned," Jen Valdez said, "and it will probably get to a point where we'll need to be more concerned. A balancing act to keep up power production. If everything goes to plan, and with no relief from the weather, Flaming Gorge will fall by as much as 27 feet a year from now, leaving Buckboard Marina even more high and dry. Though it's likely only a temporary solution amid long-term drought, there will be effects downstream too, as a U.S. Bureau of Reclamation water manager's plan to keep more water than usual from flowing out of Lake Powell on the Arizona-Utah line. Downstream, Lake Mead near Las Vegas is on track to resemble lows 4 years ago that revealed formerly submerged boats and human remains. The drastic measures are necessary to keep the Powell waterline high enough to run the power generation turbines without air getting into the system and causing damage, federal officials say. We are at the conclusion of today's YumaSun Daily program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Neil Kelly. Thank you for tuning in today for the YumaSun Daily. If you missed any part of this program, you can go to our website, sunsounds.org, and listen to it on demand under broadcast info and audio. The Wall Street Journal is next on Sun Sounds of Arizona.